Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the love and the support that you all have been giving thus far. I have a little bit of a frog in my throat as I record this intro, but the show must go on and all that, so let's just bear through it. As we open up the show all the time, I just want to encourage you all to go over to my Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. Make sure you become a subscriber. Help support the podcast. You can also support the podcast through Venmo, Cash App, PayPal. All of those are CPTL Hunter. Make sure that you all are going over to my website. I am doing some updates on the website as we speak. And just visit the website, hunterpolicetraining.com, hunterpolicetraining.com. The name of the website is LMH Police Training and Consulting. That's going to be updating the services and updating the format and all that kind of stuff. So stay tuned for all that. Head over to the Facebook page, looking to engage more, a little bit more. Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook. Once again, we're looking to start a month in a Book of the Month Club. Probably going to start that up in the beginning of February 2020. So we're going to just pick a book and just kind of go through it. Remember, if you have a promotional opportunity coming up, I'm your man to help you prepare for that, for your upcoming promotional examination. And this is not just for, let me stress this, this is not just for police officers, corrections, firefighters, anyone in any service who is up for any type of promotion, and you are not understanding why you're not getting a promotion, why you're not getting consideration, give me a call. You know, we'll go over answers, we'll go over some mock interviews. We can do this through Skype or some other video conferencing platform. It's not only for people who are in law enforcement. So if you know someone who's going through or about to go up for some type of interviewing process to become a manager or supervisor, or to just maybe some type of lateral transfer in which you have to do some type of interview process, hunterpolicetraining.com or my email, hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com, and or another email is cptlhunter@gmail.com. Hit me up and we can walk through those types of things. Let's dive into today's podcast. So for today, I recorded this episode with Dr. Alan Lipscomb back in November 2019. It's been a little bit. I mean, I really got a little bit backed up with the episodes, and that's a good thing, right? I got some good and some bad advice, I think, at the same time. The advice was to kind of, you know, put out a number of different feelers, number of different invites to have people on your podcast. With the thought process is that, 50% of them will say no. A lot of people said yes. And so that's how I got all backed up and everything. But, the thing about interviews is that these things remain timeless, right? So we can always go back and revisit these types of things. So back at the tragic death of Tatiana Jefferson down in Texas, I really kind of thought about this. And if you remember the shooting of Miss Jefferson, we saw the fact that she was actually killed in front of her nephew. I understand that that type of traumatic incident really does play a large part in the psychology and the psyche of this young man as he's going to grow up. And so I thought about this and I decided to reach out to someone who with a lot more expertise than myself. And that's how I reached out to Dr. Alan Lipscomb. So I'll run through his bio in a second here, but I really just kind of want to talk and just kind of paint the picture for you all as to why I reached out to him. And we've seen so many tragic incidences, all these different police shootings that have gone around the country, some of them extremely viral, some of them extremely violent. And we've seen not only the incidents, but we've seen how the community reacts, and we've seen how the police departments react and all that kind of stuff. So I really wanted to talk about that and what we can see as what's going on in the psychology and the trauma that surrounds these different types of officer involved shootings in which seemingly unarmed males are shot down and killed. Now we can have a totally different discussion. I'm willing to have a totally different discussion at another point in time. Are these really unjustified shootings? Just because, and let me just be very clear, just because the media says that someone was unarmed does not mean that they are not dangerous and they cannot cause serious bodily injury and or harm and or death to a police officer and or another civilian. So, you know, the media writes these narratives in order to paint a picture. But you have to be very cautious in what you take in your heart and in your mind and what you allow into your own psyche. Right. Nevertheless, there is a trauma that accompanies these types of events. And there's been a helplessness that many people and many communities have felt throughout the years. And this is what I want to talk about. If you listen to the episode with Dr. Rafael Toruella, I highly suggest you listen to that, because he talks about the trauma that many Puerto Ricans have felt on their island through colonialism and through racism, et cetera, and how, as a result of those traumatic instances that many of those people have felt throughout their lives, they have turned towards drugs to mask the pain or to ease the pain and what have you. So the same thing is happening with African-Americans as they seemingly are shot down by the police. And so we see some type of trauma that goes on. I reached out to Dr. Lipscomb, and I really appreciate him coming on. He really had a wealth of knowledge, and we're going to get into it in just a second here. So let me just read from his bio so before we get into it. Alan Eugene Lipscomb, he's got a doctorate in psychology. He's a licensed clinical social worker, assistant professor in the social work department at California State University at Northridge. Dr. Lipscomb is a clinical psychologist by education and a licensed clinical social worker in the state of California. He double majored in psychology and Black studies at UC Santa Barbara. He earned his master's of social work from the University of Southern California. In addition, Dr. Lipscomb received his doctorate in psychology with clinical emphasis in marriage, family, and child psychotherapy from Ryokan College. His areas of research are centered on the psychiatric epidemiology among racialized and marginalized individuals who have experienced trauma, complex trauma, traumatic grief, and race-based trauma. Specifically, Dr. Lipscomb has conducted numerous qualitative research studies on racialized Black identified men across the Black African diaspora in the United States, exploring the grief, loss, and complex trauma experiences. So that's a little bit about my guest. Once again, we're going to be discussing the trauma that Black men are dealing with, specifically Black men are dealing with when they see what we can call controversial police shootings at the very minimum, right? Once again, I am going to have a show about the different traumatic experiences that are going on in the hood. So if anybody's wondering about, you know, when am I going to talk about that? Yes, I am going to talk about that, right? There are people who grow up in Chicago and Detroit and all these other inner cities who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorders just like everyone else and all that kind of stuff. So I do plan on doing a show about that. So just stay tuned for that. But today's show, we're going to talk about the trauma that many African-American men feel occurs or goes on with them when they see the traumatic shooting, the viral shootings on YouTube and the news about another individual gunned down seemingly without justification. Now, there's a lot of nuances to this, and I get it. I get the nuances that go on with this, right? And I, as I've said before on my own podcast, that, you know, just because someone says something doesn't mean that it is that way. And so therefore an investigation has to come forth, and we have to wait for that investigation to go forth. But in the meantime, there is still pain. There is still trauma. And we still have to deal with the person and with the persons and people in the community in order to make them whole. That is Dr. Lipscomb's work. And so we're going to discuss a little bit about his work and what brought him to it. So once again, stay tuned. And here we go. Here's an interview with Dr. Alan Lipscomb. All right, so I'd like to welcome my special guest, Dr. Alan Lipscomb. Thank you so much for being a guest on Captain Hunter's podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in the wake of these recent tragic shootings that we've been having, it seems as if there's one every week or every other week or so, and with the most recent one of Tatiana Jefferson and her nephew being there, I decided to have you on the show and just try to understand what's going on in a psychological perspective as we go forward. How is these types of shootings that we're seeing all across the country affecting Black males and all of the Black community in particular? So that's the reason I want to have you on, and thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Definitely. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So before we get into it, just tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you got into this line of work. Did you always want to be a psychologist? Did you always want to deal with helping Black people in their emotional difficulties?
Yeah, so this my professional journey to where I am today is very personal to me. My story starts off at the age of 13. And at the age of 13, I was falsely accused of robbing a restaurant at gunpoint. Coincidentally enough, the night that they say that the robbery happened was the same night of my 13th birthday. And so that was the genesis of me wanting to help and be of service to Black folk in the Black community in a deeper psychological way because of what I went through in that experience. And so years after that, it changed the trajectory, not only of my personal life, but my professional life. I, you know, went on and double majored in psychology and Black studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I went on to get my master's in social work, concentrating on families and children, and then got licensed as a psychiatric social worker, went back to school, and got my doctorate in clinical psychology. What I say to my students, what I say to different constituents that I talk to and engage with is that I became the clinician, the therapist, the mental health advocate that I always wished that I would have had at the age of 13, given what I have gone through. And so this is my passion work. This is my macro work, and also my micro work that I continue to do ongoing in addition to my research. So I am very much a practitioner, scholar, educator. My practice drives my research, which also informs my teaching and how I show up in academic spaces. I am unapologetically a Black male researcher. I specifically look at traumatic grief and loss among Black men and how they specifically in the United States, and looking at what are effective ways to go about healing Black men who have experienced traumatic grief and loss.
Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that experience that you had as far as the feelings and emotions, if you remember them when you were 13? How that, I mean, you were obviously arrested. I don't know. Tell us, were you arrested?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I definitely remember it. You know, it's one of those things that I say it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's a blessing and a curse, right?
Right.
It was the feeling of knowing your truth and who you are, but also learning and recognizing that the exterior truth of what you represent to people and how they see you based on being a Black male body, young Black male at that time, dictates your experience psychologically and psychosocially in your community, in your environment. And so to have that, meaning that being my truth and what I know myself to be at that time, to be questioned, to be identified as someone that I knew I wasn't, but to experience law enforcement, to experience the juvenile court system, et cetera, to actually believe it was me, that does a special type of psychological trauma and injury to the young Black male psyche. And so what I carried with me and what I continue to carry with me, although I have received my own mental health services, is that of knowing that although I know I am true educator, I am a father, I am a spouse, husband, etc., I also know that how others see me based on my Blackness dictates my experience outside of my environment, outside of my home. And so no matter if law enforcement, a police car, et cetera, is on the other side of the highway, freeway, if I see them, whether it's sirens or not, there's a reaction. My body has a response to law enforcement. And to this day, it still stays with me. And that's, you know, the gift that I was talking about, better known as post-traumatic stress disorder, short PTSD, is that body memory, right, around how quickly I was believed to be someone who had committed a crime. And so going back to what you asked me, that stayed with me. And so I experienced depression at 13 years old, not knowing it, didn't have a name for it. I my parents saw that I was experiencing something. You know, they didn't name it either or know what it was. And in my family, we call it therapy, talking to someone, right? You need to talk to someone. And they asked me that. My mom asked me that, and I said yes. And so our legal representation at the time found a therapist for me to work with. And it was an older white male out here in Los Angeles, California. And I went for that first session to meet with him. And when I went into the office, he said, you know, welcome. You can have a seat anywhere. And he had a rocking chair. And I was like, I'm about to sit in that rocking chair. I'm about that rocking chair life, right? And so when I went to sit in the chair, he said, but just not there.
Wow.
And so what I learned, not only did that rupture the relationship from the beginning, but I also realized that I cannot trust what people tell me.
Wow.
While simultaneously going through this whole being seen as someone that I was not, now I'm really realizing that I can't trust, right, what people tell me. And so this could have been a corrective experience for the most part, right? Instead, what it did was it told me you cannot trust him. So I do what a lot of men of color do and youth of color do when they have to go to therapy or counseling is I start faking good, right? Oh, I'm okay. It's cool. It's whatever. Yeah, okay, I'm good, right? We did two sessions, one by myself, one with my mother and my father. And that was it, right? I was like, I'm okay. And I wasn't okay, but I knew that there probably would have been more harm done in that space than if I were to continue there. And so that goes back to what I was saying earlier regarding becoming the therapist that I always wished I had. Go ahead.
No, that's a fascinating story. So did the therapist give you a reason as to why you could not sit there?
He said, that's my chair.
So he tells you could sit anywhere, but just not there.
That part. That part.
I'm going to tell a story, and my audience has heard this before, but it kind of goes into yours. So I had last year, I had a triple bypass, and there's a great emotional, mental toll that is taken on people who go through that. And I actually had to go speak with someone as well, because it was very, I was a, you know, big, strong, although I'm not that tall, big, strong police officer. And next thing you know, I'm being humbled by this little tiny, you know, vessels in my heart and all this kind of stuff. So that really does take an emotional toll on people. And so I had to go see a therapist, and he had a rocking chair in his office. So is that something that is just going on in therapist's office, or what is that?
You know what? To this day, I have not seen another therapist's office with a rocking chair. And, you know, I have my own office now here in the state of California. And I supervise folks who are getting their hours towards licensure. And I have yet to see someone with another rocking chair. Now, not to say it doesn't exist. I think what it can provide for folks is the soothing, right? The rocking, self-soothing kind of behavior to assist with self-regulatory behavior when they're in the space. So I get it, right? Clinically, what that's about. But I was not able to allow to sit in that chair.
That's interesting. So I want to know, you only went for two sessions with him, and how, and you felt that you, as if you weren't going to get anything from them. Do you think that he was able to understand your connection? I know the sessions were short, but do you think that he actually got it, or you think it was just something he totally dismissed?
I don't think he got it. I think it was totally dismissed. And the reason why I say that is because knowing what I know now, not only as a clinician therapist, but also as an educator, because I teach students, graduate students, going into the mental health profession, how to engage, like what to do in that first initial session, et cetera. And so the fact that he did not start with it, that he didn't recognize what this must have been like. And recognizing doesn't mean you have to understand it and get it and have firsthand lived experience. It's that empathy piece that you can tap into aspects of self that can relate to the other person on that sadness, loss, right, depression level to say, I get it. I see it. I may not understand racially. I may not understand X, Y, and Z, but I get how this has impacted you. No, that never happened in the two sessions that I had.
How many of your colleagues, those of your peers who are clinical psychologists, particularly the white ones, white people, how many of them do you think understand exactly where you're coming from?
I don't even think many of them understand, to be quite honest. This is why I do the research that I do. This is why I do the types of trainings and presentations that I do, because it's no longer an excuse, right? To not know what to do, to not know how to hold space with a Black male, Black youth, et cetera, who is experiencing racialization. And I see racialization as a loss experience. That's part of the traumatic losses, right? Not just physical losses like death. I also see being racialized, right? Being targeted based on the color of your skin, right? To be said that you have done something, to be shot, murdered, etc., just because of your phenotypic presentation. I don't think many of white clinicians, therapists in the profession get it.
Wow.
To this day.
Wow. Do you think it's a willful act not to get it? I mean, is there a sense that, and I'll give you a little bit of law enforcement experience, or sure, not even so much the law enforcement experience, I think just a general experience as to if something happens, they automatically see the negative that's in the person, right? So we see the situation that happened in New York, Eric Garner, right? So they say that if Eric Garner just sort of surrendered, Eric Garner should have just not been selling cigarettes, yada, yada, yada. Does that play a part in it, where they think that we are bringing on this torment to ourselves, we're bringing on these problems to ourselves, if we just comply, if we just have better jobs, if we just do whatever, then these things won't happen to us?
Yeah, what happens is because as a country, we have learned that we don't talk about all things race and race relations. And so what has happened on a more psychological level is that there's a cognitive dissonance that happens. So when folk see things like that in New York or with the brothers in Philly, right, at Starbucks, when they see that, something happens on a deeper psychological level that needs to say to the person that this is not about race. Mm. And so they create a narrative to lessen their discomfort around the race aspect. So that's the other story, right? And so what I coin it as is rescuing another narrative outside of the narrative that is true in the space. Right. So instead of saying, yes, Eric Garner was blah, 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 because of being Black male, being a big Black male, the brothers in Philly, because they were Black, being targeted, you know, blah, 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 blah. To lessen that, they say, well, it's because of this. Here's another narrative they're bringing in there. It's because they're doing their job. It's because they didn't pay for anything. It's because he resisted. Right? It's because he didn't put his hands up. Right? And so there's always this rescuing another narrative. So what I challenge people, I say, what was it about my narrative or the Black person's narrative that you needed to leave it and go and rescue another narrative?
Right. Why can't it ever just be us? Why can't it ever just be us?
Right. And in addition to that, why can't there be multiple truths that exist in the space?
Good point.
Right? So could he have resisted? Yes. Did that play out? Yes. But what also happened simultaneously is that he was choked to death. What also happened is that there were multiple, you know, officers who took him down. So there's multiple truths that exist in the space as opposed to there being only one truth. And so what I notice, people try to defend only one truth, but there could be multiple truths that exist in the space. And that's the thing around holding, going back to the earlier question, holding white clinicians, therapists accountable for how to show up in the space when they're working with Black males or Black folk in general who are sharing narratives that they can't relate to. You don't need to rescue another narrative that's not in the space because you're uncomfortable. What you need to do is challenge yourself to stay in it and connect it and validate, honor the truth that is given in the space.
Do you give presentations to other clinicians to tell them this type
of thing? I do.
And how is that received?
You know, for the most part, it's received very well. To this date, when I do my presentations on Black male grief and trauma, I will inevitably get someone, one person, who will either raise their hand or come up to me at the end of my talk and say, "This is great, however, comma, how come you're not focusing on such and such men? Why only Black men? Right? Why not Latino males? Why not, you know, Asian American? Why not First Natives, etc.?" And what I tell them is that if I were presenting research on, let's say, ovarian cancer, would you have asked me at the end of that presentation, how come I'm not doing research on testicular cancer? Again, there's something about the race piece. There's something about talking about Black, all things Black and race and racism, et cetera, that people cannot tolerate, especially white folk. And so what happens is they're wanting to bring others into the story. Well, like I said, I'm unapologetically doing Black male grief research. Why? Because it's not being done. Why? Because I have a responsibility as a Black male researcher, educator, clinician to highlight these stories, to highlight effective ways to not only further traumatize, but also to check oneself so that they can provide therapeutic healing spaces that will allow for Black men and Black folk to really heal.
Wow. That's powerful stuff. Thank you so much for doing that research.
For sure.
I do know, I know of you, and I also know of another psychologist, Tommy Curry. No, he's a sociologist. Tommy Curry, I think his name is, from Texas A&M. But anyway, I'm glad that people are looking at this and going forward with the studies. So I wanted to talk about an article that you wrote, Black Male Hunting.
Phenomenological Study Exploring the Secondary Impact of Stephon Clark's Murder.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
No problem. It's a mouthful.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So as I was reading through it, you have... In the abstract, you have three major themes, and I want to discuss these three major themes because this is what plays out so many times when we see these types of traumas. But before we get to that, I did want to ask you. Now, we contrast this, and I heard this before, and I want to get your perspective on this. When we see these types of murders or these types of police shootings on TV or internet or however we're viewing them, obviously, Black folk have one type of reaction to it. I want to talk about have you ever explored the white folks' response to it? And I've heard that some people have viewed it as a type of sick type of porn where they're just kind of just watching this and almost an entertainment type of value to it. Have you heard of that, studied that, looked into that at all?
You know, I haven't specifically looked at that. What I have heard and seen over the years of doing this work is that there is a level of desensitization, right? So for some white folks, they are activated by this in a positive way, right? Wanting to do some activism around this, some advocacy around this. But then you have white folks who are more desensitized by it. And that goes back to what I was touching on earlier, this kind of this cognitive dissonance, if you will, to disconnect from the psychological trauma of just witnessing it, right? And so now I'm desensitized from it, so I don't have that same level of reaction. And also how, as a country, how they have desensitized the reaction of our society around all things Black. There are studies that have been done around when you show that of a Black person being attacked, mugged, et cetera, versus a white person being attacked, mugged, et cetera. There's a different reaction for white folks, right? The white fragility shows up in a different way. The white reaction shows up in a different way when it's someone who is white. And we see the responses are different, too. And so that connects to what you were just bringing up.
Once again, interesting stuff. So these three themes that you wrote in here, first one is, and I want you to talk about them in order, please. Emotional reactions of anger and sadness among Black men. That's the first one. The second one is psychophysiological symptoms of hypervigilance, avoidance, and disassociation. And the third is injustices around Black male bodies being targeted. So the first one, again, is emotional reactions of anger and sadness among Black men.
Yes. And so just to give a little context for those who are listening to this. So this was a study that I did following the death, the murder of Stephon Clark in Sacramento by Sacramento police. And what I did was what is referred to as rapid response research. Right. Rapid response research, in essence, is studying a phenomenon as it is unfolding. And so when that happened, I believe it was on a Sunday in 2018, in March 2018, I quickly, over the weekend, I did my IRB proposal to submit it to my institution to get the green light to actually study this as it was happening. And so within 2 weeks, I got approval within my institution to go ahead and do a rapid research. And so what I did was I created a survey, an open-ended exploratory qualitative survey, and I surveyed 62 Black men across the United States. Majority was from the state of California. And what I did was I did a thematic analysis of those open-ended questions, read over them, coded them, analyzed them, and then the results are what you just identified, the three common themes. And so the first theme, which is emotional reactions of anger and sadness among Black men. And that is when Black men saw this, when they heard about it, or when they read about it, they had a reaction of being sad by it or being upset and angry that here we go again. There's another unarmed Black man who was murdered in the backyard of his grandmother's home. Right. And so I saw that, you know, a quarter of the men who responded in the research and the study were saying, I felt angry. I felt sad. It's sad because what does this mean for us? Right. What does this mean as we continue to live as Black folk? And that goes into the third theme. But I'll hold off on touching on that. And so that was the first theme that I noticed. There's a sense of anger and there's a sense of sadness that happens.
So to be fair, many white people would also be saddened by that as well. So but I would assume that you're talking about a specific I don't know what the psychological term for it would be, and I should know that I have a degree in psychology. But what the differences are, right? There's a level to this, right? That's too sad, and there's a deep seated sadness that we feel because we understand. And yes, I was a police officer, but I'm a Black male. Is I understand that this could happen to me. I understand that this could happen to my son, who's living in Tacoma, Washington right now, or it can happen to my stepson who is in Florida right now. So that there's an internalization that goes on.
There's a deeper cultural wounding around this sadness and anger where you realize that you are disposable. And that creates the anger, and that creates the sadness that happens specifically among Black men, right? Because it becomes scary, because it's so real. It's in your face. We're not talking about one every 50 years.
Right.
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 And so that's the psychological impact that you were touching on in the examples that you were giving. It wounds at a deeper level because it's your fate. It's your reality that is very true. And it's saddening and it's enraging that right. you can't do anything about it.
And then we get this cultural pushback because I'm saying the same thing that Obama said when Trayvon Martin was killed, that this could have been him or his son. That's what Obama said.
Correct.
And once again, as you mentioned a couple of times now, is that there's this pushback or there's this need to, and I like how you phrased it, need to rescue the narrative from the narrative, right? Why can't we're not? And I like how you put it about the cancer studies and all that. If I'm talking about breast cancer, why do we got to talk about testicular cancer? Let's just deal with this. And this is where we get this all lives matter from, or even the blue lives matter type of thing.
Correct. Yeah, right. So we get into this whole, you know, struggle Olympics, right? Oppression Olympics, right? Who's suffering more? Whose lives really matter? And in the reality of it, in the whole movement of the Black Lives Matter, they're not saying others' lives do not matter. What they are saying is because of this epidemic, what are we doing about Black lives? Are we saying that we don't care as much as other lives? Because when we look at the numbers, I mean, I was LA Times published an article back in August of this year saying one of the leading causes of death in the United States among Black men is being shot by law enforcement.
I read that. Yeah, I read that.
Come on now. What is that? We're not talking about heart disease and heart attack, right? We're not talking about cancer.
We would do something about that. We would have forms about it. Change your diet.
We would do, yes, yes. There would be a major ringing of the alarm. So yes, this goes back to what I was touching on and what some of the themes were highlighting, and that's the anger and that's the sadness piece, the reality that Black lives do not matter. Because if they did, there would be a different response and reaction as a nation, as a society, as a country.
Ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Crazy. So let's talk about number two, the psychophysiological symptoms of hypervigilance, avoidance, and disassociation.
Yes. And so what some of the Black men were identifying is that they are now afraid, right, to leave their at certain times, right? And so there is this rapid like heartbeat that's happening. They are constantly checking and scanning, right? When they're out in the community in different spaces, workspaces, school spaces, etc. And that's that hypervigilance piece that they don't feel comfortable just being. So they always have to look over their heads to make sure, right, no one's coming after them, specifically someone who has a gun just based on how they present, right, or law enforcement, right, wrongfully accused of having something or having said that you have a gun when actuality it's your cell phone. So there's this avoidance piece, too, that happens where they're avoiding spaces and places, right, that they are out in the public. Right. And then also with the disassociation piece, needing to disconnect, because if I say that this is my truth, then that impacts me. So a level of it is I need to disassociate from this so I can continue to function as a Black man. Right. Because it's so overwhelming to take that in. So I have to kind of remove myself psychologically and disassociate a level of this just to keep functioning as a Black male. Is what we were hearing.
And so are they disassociating themselves from society, from calling the police, from going in certain spaces?
It's all of the above. It's not only just disassociating from, you know, calling the police, but it's also needing to do things to release and escape, right? So this is where we see some of the substance use narratives. Because it's so overwhelming. So some of the men stated things like, you know, I smoke and get high because it's too much, right? So again, this self-medicating, this disassociating, needing to disconnect from one's body or reality becomes a truth experience for some folks.
Wow. Now, did you feel any of this when you were 13, when you went through your experience?
Yes, the hypervigilance and the sadness was definitely my experience, for sure. And continue to be my experience, right? And so I was sharing with a colleague a couple of years back that I keep all my receipts. When I go to the store, gas station, et cetera, I keep all my receipts because that's proof that I was at a place at that time, et cetera, right? And so just that impact that it has on me. Now we got things, you know, with social media, you can check in places, right?
And
they're checking in for you. And, there's surveillance cameras and all this stuff that's out there now that wasn't quite out there back in the day. But that's the impact that it had on me, where I constantly need to keep things as proof and evidence that I am where I said I was at, so that I don't ever feel like somebody can say that I was somewhere that I wasn't and did something that I did not do.
Mm. I'll get to this third point in a minute, but you just kind of reminded me of something. When we are at a store, when I'm in a store, sometimes I have a hood on or I have a hat on. I will, and I realize that I take time to take that hood off, to adjust my hat so my eyes are visible. And I noticed one time I did that. I had a hood on. It was raining outside. I went into the store. I took my hood off. And then a white person walked in behind me, had their hood on, and didn't take it off. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is obviously some form of my own trying to make sure that I present myself as non-threatening to people, right? Because I'm thinking about Trayvon Martin, probably thinking about stuff that happened to me years ago, even, you know, as a teenager myself. I'm in my 40s now, but obviously, you know, this is an internalized mechanism that I'm trying to present myself as I'm not threatening.
Oh, for sure. And this is that hypervigilance piece that I was just touching on with the second theme. So you brought up that. Now, here's mine. When I walk my dog in the evening and it's cold, I don't wear my hoodie. Wow. I keep my hoodie off. Wow. Why? Because it's dark. I'm walking my dog. Right? If I have my hoodie on, then that, in my eyes, right, says that I am somebody who, you know, is suspect or shouldn't be in this neighborhood or whatever. So why is it that you and me both have similar experiences? This is the psychological impact and the wounding that I was talking about of secondary trauma of being exposed to it in that article that I wrote in this research, is that we take on these symptoms. And it changes and it impacts how we move day to day as Black bodies in society. So you're going into the store, I'm walking my dog. And I'm sure, if, you know, other folks who hear this, they're doing things like this too. Why? Because of what we know to be true. Why? Because what we have seen and experienced. Another reason why I did this particular research is because according to the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5, which we in the mental health community use to classify and diagnose mental health related disorders, they do not see secondary exposure to a traumatic event as a form of PTSD symptoms. So if I saw the murder on social media or on the television, that I can't have PTSD. However, if I worked, right, with law enforcement, or I was a medical physician and I was exposed to it, then I could. But if you are removed from it and it is not your profession, you cannot be classified as having a PTSD symptom being secondarily exposed to traumatic experiences. So why is it that we have these reactions and responses of not wearing our hoodies, right? But then again, that's not something that folks clinically are checking for as a concern and a symptom. So what it creates is this erasure of racialized experiences that are real and impact the individual on a psychological level. We're not even part of the mental health narrative to be true.
Mm. is the, there's a Black Psychological Association, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are they trying to push for any type of recognition as to what we're talking about? So it would be clinically diagnosed. Are they pushing for that?
I don't know necessarily that they're pushing for that versus initiatives around being anti-oppressive, right? Initiatives around being more inclusive and recognizing these types of trauma. Yes, we are seeing more and more of that in clinical and mental health spaces where they are looking at other forms of trauma, race-based trauma and racialized trauma. And there's a lot of folks that are doing research around this very phenomenon.
Mm. Excellent.
So we're seeing more and more of this coming up. Yeah.
Well, that's excellent. It's excellent. So the third theme that you mentioned is injustices around Black male bodies being targeted. So do you feel as if we are being targeted? Now, that's a harsh word.
Yes. I think there, what came about in the results of this particular study is many Black men were saying, I feel like I have a target on my back, that I am more likely to be shot, killed by law enforcement because of my skin. And for that reason alone, I feel like I am wearing a target, that I don't have to be doing anything, right? I can be, what were they doing in the Bay Area, having a barbecue,
right?
People telling them that they can't be here. I can go and take a shortcut home from school, be a teenager wearing a hoodie. I can be on the corner, right, at a certain part of my city, community. Regardless, I can be in Starbucks waiting, right?
At Yale sleeping.
Regardless, you see what I'm saying? It doesn't matter. Right. I'm just living, right? We can just be living as Black folk, and there is a target. And for that reason alone, there's the injustices around just being Black male body or a Black person.
Further down in the article, you write that, in addition, further research is necessary in identifying additional cultural and historical barriers that may impede treatment for this vulnerable population if experiencing secondary race-based trauma. Talk about those cultural and historical barriers that impede the treatment.
So the biggest one is trust. There is a lack of trust, rightfully so, in the Black community. And also with that, right, so let me stay with that for a second. There is a lack of trust because what has happened to Black folk when they have gotten help, and what has been done to Black folk when they didn't even want the help, but they were given, right, certain diseases and illnesses, not even knowing what they were given. So there is a mistrust of medical professionals, mental health professionals. And if I do go, right, and quote unquote, talk to someone, what does that then say about me? Does this mean I am crazy? Right? Does this make me crazy? Is what we hear. I hear a lot of this from folks. Does it mean I'm crazy? What are you going to do now? So there's a fear of what happens if I go and talk to a therapist and they deem me as quote unquote crazy. Right? And so these are some of the cultural challenges and barriers that are no fault of our own, right? It's of our society. And I think there is also a responsibility from that needs to happen with the Black church.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that in an accusatory or blaming way. What I'm saying is in a collaboratory way, right? To collaborate, I think more mental health professionals need to collaborate with the church, the Black church, to really look at how do we promote mental health and wellness? How do we provide these resources and services to the Black community? Because by and large, what we know to be true is that that's who we trust as Black folks.
Right.
We trust, right, the Black church. And so one of the interventions I would say in the future that needs to happen, and there's a lot of talk around this, and there's a lot of work that's being done with a lot of churches too. So I don't want to take away from the work that's being done. But I think more can be done and visible around collaborating with the church and bringing in. There should be a mental health therapist in every church, several mental health clinicians in every church, right? That's the type of intervention, proactive things that I'm talking about. Because what we know to be true, we've seen it in the civil rights movement, et cetera, is that that's where we get a lot of the support. And so if nobody else is checking for us, if nobody else is providing these types of healing spaces, we look to our church to provide these mental health healing spaces as well.
Yes, I do think there certainly is a lack of trust, and people do trust the church, and that's where they, and I agree with that. I agree with your assessment that that's where we need to turn to in order to get the things that we need. And I've been very disappointed in the churches that I've gone to throughout my years, and I'm not going to bash the church either, but I've just been disappointed because I think that they've had plenty of opportunity to be on the cutting edge of so many different things, and they mm-hmm. have missed the mark and mm-hmm. Let their communities down in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So give us some good news as far as what we can do. We're talking about the church. What can we expect, right? So give us some good news about how we can beat this trauma, how we can learn from these types of incidents. What can we expect?
So the good news is that we can name it. We can call it what it is, and we can come together as a group to validate each other's experiences around these traumas. We can hold meetings, we can hold spaces together and talk about this. I think that's the quickest thing that we can do as a community is to really talk about this. We can continue to make it visible as a community. I mean, hence why I did this particular work and you saw it, right? And so talking about it, making it visible, how we use social media as a platform to support one another, to let people know that you are not quote unquote crazy, is another way that we can do this. Also, how we advocate in activism. You know, I was talking earlier about, I think you were asking me something around white mental health folks, white therapists, and what they can do. We need allyship, right? There hasn't been no movement that has happened in the United States without allyship. So this is not excusing white folk, right? There are some white folk who want to be down for the cause and the culture and activism. So we need you. We need you to show up. There are times where we don't need your voice, and there are times where we do need your voice too, because you get into spaces and places that we don't always have the privilege and access to get into.
Right.
So I think there's that collective activism and advocacy that needs to continue to happen. We need to continue to talk about this, because if we do not, then it's not going to get talked about at all.
Very true. What can we expect, and this will be the final question, what can we expect from Atiana's, Jefferson's nephew, and the couple from Phoenix with the police officer who was recently fired for threatening them with, threatening to kill him over a doll, that family? What can we expect from the children of those traumatic incidents?
We can for sure expect there to be some psychological wounding. Some psychological wounding and some cultural injuries as it relates to those specific incidents that have happened. We can also expect that they're going to need some ongoing mental health support and resources to promote their healing, to mitigate the impact that it's going to have on both of them, is what we can expect for sure.
Just for the last point here, I know that I said the last point was the last point, but this is the last point.
That's okay.
We're talking about black men, talking about the history of how we have been treated. I assume that you're talking about the syphilis situations and all the other stuff that was done to us.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us and talk to the black men out there who may be listening, and even white men as well. Everyone, talk about how important it is to be concerned about your mental health, not to be concerned about the stigmas about mental health. Just break that down for us.
Sure. Just like when we are looking for a place to stay, looking for a car, you get to shop around and find a goodness of fit of a therapist who you feel comfortable with. Do not stop with just the first person you meet. You may have to continue for a minute until you find someone. That's the one piece. The other piece is that do not feel bad for reaching out for help. Do not feel like you are less than a man because you recognize that you are experiencing depression, that you are experiencing anxiety. That is strength that takes courage to actually go and talk to someone and reach out for support. You don't have to suffer in silence. There are resources out there. There are many folks out there who are willing and ready to provide support specifically to Black men. And for my white folk out there, there are spaces where we need you to show up for Black men, where you can be a mental health advocate in those clinical spaces, right? Showing up. And so you too are called to order and needing to be a part of the healing process for Black men.
Very well. Thank you. And well said. Dr. Liscombe, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Tell us about what you have coming up. Are you writing any books, any other research? Do you have a website? How can people contact you?
So for folks who are interested in reaching out to me, I can be emailed at allen@cscomb.edu. And I will be in the new year, let's see, February, I will be in New York. I will be at Albany presenting there for the School of Social Work on Black male grief there. So if you're interested in that, please email me and I can send you some information regarding that. I'll also post it on social media. I am in the process of writing my second book. It is a book of anthology, taking collections of narratives, poems, lyrics, etc., of Black men and their trauma and their healing process. And so that should be coming out within the next year or two. In addition to that, I am working on a dance narrative of my Black male grief work and research, where someone, a young brother that I met this year during the summer, he is an artist in his own right and a dancer, and he is going to perform through the Black male grief narrative and research. And so that's coming in the spring, early summer of 2020. And so that's what's coming up for me. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. I really, really appreciated the conversation. It was very enlightening. And I'd like to have you back on if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, for sure. Definitely.
Absolutely. And you're out there. You're going to be out there in Albany. So I live in Connecticut. So maybe I'll swing up there and check you out.
Sounds good. Oh, yes. Please do.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. So thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. And we'll talk to you again. So I want to thank my special guest, Dr. Allen Liscombe, for coming on the Captain Hunter's podcast. Very informative conversation. I hope that you, the listener, were really enlightened. Give it some thought to what he said. You know, this whole Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, right? Nobody says that kind of stuff with cancer. We've been through this before. We've had these discussions before, but just give it a little bit of thought as to what he's saying. And so I hope that you all learned something. And once again, just hit me back in the podcast if there's a subject you'd like me to talk about, cptlhunter@gmail.com. Remember, you can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, or Venmo. Also, the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys learned something, and I hope you all are enjoying this ride with us. So that's it. Much love and much peace.